United States Senator Mark Hatfield from Oregon was presented to the convention by the Christian Life Commission for the following address.
Dr. Valentine, Mr. President, distinguished officials, messengers, and friends. Mr. President, I perhaps should make a motion that we extend the order of business to include my speech now by about 15 minutes, but I think I'll pass that.
Take the time allotted.
Ladies and gentlemen, I feel a great privilege in being invited to address this Southern Baptist Convention. I do not feel a stranger in your midst, even though I belong to a different convention, that of the Conservative Baptists of America. I want you to know that I believe in the ecumenical movement, and therefore I would like to start right here in saying that we could start an ecumenical movement right within the Baptist denomination, and I extend an invitation to all of you to join the Conservative Baptists of America. The Great Commission that Jesus Christ said to his disciples and to his church was threefold. And I'd like to use this as my text for a few comments with you this morning. First of all, he said, go teach all nations. Second part of that commission was, baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And the third part of that commission to all of us as Christian was, teach them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And then he promised to be with us always until the end of the world. I believe that the scriptures are very clear as to what Christ meant by that third part of the Great Commission. Yet this is the aspect of our mission which we most often fail to accomplish. Let us take, for example, the very important matter of Christ dealing with human suffering and need. The life of Christ, as recorded in the Gospels, is crystal clear on the point that God does not intend that human beings should suffer endlessly under pressures of poverty, hunger, social decay, racial persecution, disease, ignorance, unemployment, war, or violence. The major part of Christ's public ministry on earth was spent in healing of human suffering, in alleviating the sickness and social deprivation of mankind. Christ did heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the leper, fed the multitudes, gave purpose to the wandering, sight to the blind, forgiveness to the repentant. And then he said, greater things than I have done, you shall do. Keep my commandments if you love me. I believe that there has developed within the church a spirit of withdrawal from the world, of seclusion, of non-involvement. Some people have left the church spiritually to join the task of using the powers of the state to create a perfect world and to legislate virtue. They have cared for man's social and temporal needs, while others have taken a suspicious look at these advocates of the social gospel and have decided not to become involved in the worldly affairs of man and have tended only to the soul and to the defense of theology. Both groups, I submit to you this morning, both groups are forgetting the example of Jesus Christ. Parenthetically, it should be stated that Christians in this country, and the mission fields especially, throughout the entire world have done a creditable job of pioneering in the social concern for suffering mankind. We dare not forget the loving sacrifice of Christian men and women who have sought to rescue the soul, the mind, and the body of men in every nation of the world. And I think it is from this lesson of the missionaries where they have been successful that we could take great stock today. Because we find that there have been missionary doors closed. Countries under political philosophies and political policies have said to our missionaries in all the churches of the Christian faith, no longer are you permitted to come to our land to preach this gospel. But we have found that where the missionaries have created an indigenous native church and leadership, that the removal of the missionary has not called for the cessation of the spreading of the gospel, but rather these indigenous groups, these who have learned a sense of independence, have stood on their own feet and carried forth the commandment. And that is because they have been committed to a cause, to a person, and they have been willing to sacrifice. Is there not an analogy that we can draw today in the world of war? An analogy that says to us very clearly, regardless of our political label, regardless of our political philosophy, regardless of our religious persuasion, that men who are helping themselves are men whom we have a responsibility to help, but that we cannot do for other men that which they are not willing to do for themselves. John Foster Dulles and the late John F. Kennedy very eloquently translated this into the world of international politics when they said, you cannot superimpose a cause of freedom upon another man unless he is willing to fight and die for it himself. That is why that some of us are concerned in this country, that we are involved in a quicksand of an Asian war that calls for more and more and more American boys, 500,000, at the same time that the desertion rates of the South Vietnamese Army continue to mount. And that we now have to take over the pacification program. And we ask the question, why, if our boys are called upon to go fight other men's wars, why are not the words of our president, which were so eloquently stated in 1964, just as true today as they were then, when he said to the American people, this is an Asian war that must be fought by Asian boys. This is an example of why I say questions must be asked. Are we called upon to do for other men that which they are not willing to do for themselves? We must be willing always to stand by to aid and abet the cause of liberty and freedom and the cause of mankind throughout the entire world. That's our role of world leadership. But my friends, let us not forget that the United States of America does have limitation of resources, both manpower and natural resources and material resources. And we cannot become a world policeman and dissipate our resources all over the world wherever a crisis may evolve. And that all nations have a responsibility, especially those who are the peace-loving democratic nations, to give leadership to the cause of peace. And that our nation must hear a voice from the people that say, in effect, to our government, this voice must say, we want to uphold our responsibilities, but we believe that we have an obligation to use our creative genius in finding alternatives to war. Alternatives that will not consign our youth, our greatest national resource, to an endless conflict that's been going on for 20 years, in which the French have lost 96,000 dead troops before we moved in to lose over 10,000 today. And yet we're told it may go on another 2 or 10 or 20 more years. These are the questions that we raise today in the area of Christian social concern. Not that we're all going to agree, no. But all we ask today as Christians, as American citizens, is for dialogue, accurate information, facts upon which we can depend and move with our judgments and our evaluations. And I believe that we must, therefore, as Christians, be involved in these great issues. And we cannot abdicate them to the politicians, no matter how astute. Nor can we abdicate them to the diplomats or to the military generals. This is a responsibility of all citizens of this nation. We also have the great concern as Christians in the world today for man's physical well-being, as represented by his needs of the physical body. A recent magazine ad stated that if the hungry of the earth were lined up at your front door, they would move and circumnavigate the globe 45 times. Jesus Christ said, "Feed my sheep." I don't believe that people who have never seen hunger can truly imagine the horrors of hunger. May I share with you something that will never have been removed from my mind, no matter what my age or what my experience. It was in 1945 that part of the United States Navy, of which I was serving, was ordered into the port of Haiphong, then called Indochina. And we there were to pick up the remnants and the other parts of the 53rd Division of Chiang Kai-shek's Nationalist Army. And we were to take them aboard our ship and up around the coast of China into northern China to fight the Chinese communists. This was after the conclusion of the World War II. And I recall that as we went into that port that morning, that we could see the troops that were lined up on the beach ready to move aboard our ships. And we could see the sacks of rice which they had brought with them to be their feed and their food supply. And we could see the Vietnamese women with large baskets in their arms. And as these sacks of rice were lifted from the beach, they would literally dig with their hands into the sand to pick up the few kernels of rice which had sifted through the burlap bags, to put into their baskets, later to sift out of their baskets in order to try to keep body and soul together. And as we moved into the city of Hanoi, along that road, we saw dead Vietnamese, dead not because of bullet wounds, but dead because of starvation, grinding starvation. And I submit to you this morning that hunger will shape the destinies of more nations, their political philosophies, and their ultimate activities than any other force in the world today. Oh, we in America, in the well-fed part of the world, do not comprehend this in many instances. The missionary does, and the churchman who has been a supporter of and acquainted with and close to that missionary understands. But do you realize that in many parts of the world that they spend 4/5 of their annual average income of $100 just for food? And many of us in America spend over $100 just to keep our pets alive and well fed. I did not come here to indict the agricultural progress of America. It's magnificent. But all I'm saying is that this agricultural progress has tended to make many Americans oblivious to the hunger in the rest of the world. And we as Christians have this as a clear obligation to see our relationship to the world and to these problems. What has happened? Has the church failed in its mission? Has the church lost its impetus to help troubled and hungry people? Christ told us to dare, to sacrifice, to use our resources for the service of others. But many times today in America, we tend to cater more and more to our own congregations. Do we assume the responsibility for the whole community in which we are situated, and even of the world in which we are a part? Here is God and his commandments for social concern on one hand, and here is the need of the world and of man on the other hand. And the Christian is supposed to be the minister of reconciliation, bringing together God's resources and man's need. The Christian is to be the instrument of the total solution to the problem. Often when men come to church seeking meaning to their lives, they are offered a cup of coffee, rather than a demand upon conscience. The church has been rendering to Caesar its role of concern for people. The Good Samaritan story might be edited a bit. He is the man today who votes to give other people's money to anybody left hurt along the wayside. Or as one Kentucky lawyer put it, we Christianized the federal government because we would not tithe to do the job ourselves. Too many Christians today have no twinge of conscience when he passes a sick man on the road. He rationalizes to himself that after all, he has paid the Good Samaritan to come along after him to take care of this rather unpleasant social obligation. The average layman in our church today, too many times, is often left with an incomplete Christian experience. By abdication of his concern for others, by deliberate delegation of his Good Samaritan responsibility, the church, in effect, leads its members into the sin of self-concern. The layman is invited to use the church for only self-improvement instead of service as well. The Christian of all men on earth should be the best qualified, the most able to relieve human suffering and to change the world in which he lives. No other culture or religious background has given birth to social progress equal to that made in Christian lands. Why is this? The theology of the Christian faith, I believe, is the source and the reason. Because it releases the creative energies of man for his life here on earth. Many religions are oriented toward preparing man for the life hereafter only. They are what we would call otherworldly. They try to negate man's life here on earth. They ignore the suffering of man on earth. They point always to the release from suffering, which will come only after death. But there is never the security, the assurance in these religions that life after death is guaranteed. The tension of this insecurity keeps the followers of these religions oriented to the mystery of the other world. But look at Christianity. The resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead guarantees our life after death. God has given us victory over death and the fear of what lies beyond the grave. Our faith then is secure. Our eternal destiny is established. So now, because of this truth and because of the love dynamic of Christ, we can turn our efforts and our creative energies to the revolutionizing of our world, to the alleviating of the suffering of man, and to the work of God on earth. This is the potential, but we have fallen short. We have oftentimes painted Jesus Christ into a respectable, suburban, stand-pat establishmentarianism, defending the status quo, instead of recognizing him as the greatest political and social and economic and spiritual revolutionary the world has ever known. And so today, we find that the most critical of the government's welfare program and poverty programs often comes from Orthodox evangelical Christians. They say that government cannot eliminate poverty without changing the poverty of the spirit. And they are right. They criticize the government by saying that it is trying to change the society without changing the heart of man. And they are right. They accuse the government of trying to legislate virtue without redeeming man from his sin. And they are right. Yet, all of these criticisms are made from the safety of our churches, isolated many times from the social needs of the world. We point the critical fingers at the government, at the war on poverty, at the social gospeliers, But many times we refuse to obey the mandate of Christ to heal, to redeem, to feed, to nourish the spirit, to cleanse and uplift, to educate and change the heart, to house and clothe and share the love of Christ. If the church had been doing the job it had been called to do, and which only it can do rightly, there would be no need for the government to enter the picture. It is high time that the Church of Christ obeyed her Lord and took up the task of meeting the social needs of the world in the love and power of Christ. Let me give you an example of what can be done with a pressing domestic problem. The hardcore unemployment today in America is totaled about 1 million. And yet we have today in America 118 million people in 320,000 churches, church congregations in America. If each church congregation only took the responsibility of three such persons in this hardcore of unemployables, I think we could see that this kind of welfare program would never be necessary, and that we could correct and wipe out this particular social problem. But we believe that human beings can be changed. We as Christians believe they can be redeemed and they can be renewed. And the Christian should know, of all people, that you cannot train a man for a new job without giving him a new purpose in life. And we Christians should know that you cannot heal a man's body without also healing his spirit, his soul. We Christians should know that you cannot feed a man without nourishing the spiritual hunger of his heart. This, to me, is the great challenge and the call of the Christian church today, and of the individuals who are redeemed people of God, to go forth and to identify and to involve themselves in the completion of the commandment, the third part of the commandment. Teach them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And remember the other words of our Lord, what he said. If we seem to be discouraged and tend to believe that the task is insurmountable, when he said to us, "And greater things than I have done, you shall do."